Was it satisfactory? Can I see it? Wearily, Edith ran the abbreviated interview on Camera One's monitor. Munasinghe watched himself, fascinated. Edith wondered if the network suits would play the interview. They had made it clear they wanted to cooperate with the UN, and this interview could stir a lot of hostility toward the peacekeepers if it was aired. No, she told herself, they'll play it. They'll have to. So the UN bitches about it, so what? This is news! Touchdown minus 27 hours, 51 minutes. The mercenary returned to his quarters and sat on his bunk. The time to strike is nearly here, he told himself. The situation was almost ludicrous. The more he thought about the base's electrical power supplies, its life support systems, its total lack of weaponry or military capability, the more he realized that a single man like himself could bring the entire base to its knees. They won't need a ship full of peacekeepers. I can do it all by myself. But the peacekeepers were on their way, and there was almost nothing that the inhabitants of Moonbase could do to stop them. Why assassinate the leaders when they can't offer any resistance? Just knock out their electrical power system and they're helpless. It won't make any difference if Doug Stavanger lives or dies. Moonbase will cave in as soon as the peacekeepers arrive. The mercenary got down onto the floor in front of his bunk and folded his legs into the lotus position. Resting the backs of his hands on his knees, he closed his eyes and murmured his mantra, seeking harmony and understanding. He saw, in his mind's eye, what he always saw. His 10-year-old brother in convulsions, dying of the zip he had snorted while their mother lay sprawled on the sofa, too dazed with the same shit to phone for help. He saw his 6-year-old self locked in the dark roach closet because he'd been a bad boy, watching his brother die through the closet door keyhole, listening to the screams that turned into strangled, choking sobs, and finally ended in a groan that still tortured his soul. If I had been good, I wouldn't have been locked in the roach closet. I could have helped Timmy. He saw his mother die, too. She was the first person he ever killed. He was 15 and a father, but she still treated him like a little kid, took the strap to him. He grabbed it away from her and swung it hard enough to knock her down. Her head cracked on the table leg and her eyes went blank. He saw his first sergeant, as brutal a man as any, but fair and unwaveringly honest. And the old cowboy on the rifle range, the one who taught him how to shoot and how to hunt. Death was his companion always, his ancient friend. He was death's best assistant. That was his destiny, his purpose in life, to bring people to death. He opened his eyes. Deep within him, the ancient calm had returned. There were no doubts, no qualms, no divisions within him. He was one again, whole. Death was at his side, invisible but palpable, his oldest and best companion. After all, he told himself, Stavanger's entire life revolves around Moonbase. Take that away from him and he's as good as dead anyway. I'll merely be helping him to the place where he wants to be. Still, he sighed. Touchdown minus 20 hours. Joanna Stavanger actually felt nervous as she sat in her favorite armchair, waiting for Georges Faure's call. The Secretary General had at first refused to speak to her at all, but the threat of telling the media that he planned to use nanomachines despite his public denouncement of them apparently had forced his hand. Apparently, she reminded herself, the little bastard's waited until the troop ship is almost ready to land before agreeing to talk to me. Faure had put up conditions. This was to be strictly a private conversation between the two of them. No third parties. And it was to be understood that he was speaking to her as a courtesy only, not in his capacity as Secretary General of the United Nations. Joanna had agreed easily. She knew that Faure had no private existence. Whatever he said to her was being said by the man who headed the UN. And she conveniently forgot her pledge of privacy when she told her son that Foray was going to speak to her. Doug was not in her sitting room with her, but he was plugged into their conversation in his own quarters. Precisely at the appointed moment, the synthesized voice of the communication system said, "Monsieur Foray is calling from New York."
"On screen, please," Joanna replied.
A window seemed to open on the wall before her, and Foray's face appeared, no larger than life size. Joanna had programmed the smart wall that way. She had no desire to see Foray looming over her like an intimidating giant.
"Madame Brudnoy," Foray said with a polite little smile.
"Mr. Secretary General," Joanna replied. While she waited the 3 seconds for his reply, Joanna examined the room in which Foray was sitting. It didn't look like an office, more like the living room of a spacious apartment in a high-rise building. She could not see much of the background behind him, but there was a window that looked out on the skyscrapers of Manhattan. "I am not speaking as the Secretary General, madame. This is a personal conversation between two private citizens." Joanna nodded in acknowledgement. "May I say that you look radiant, and your apartment, from what I can see of it, seems quite charming. I had no idea such luxuries were to be found in Moonbase." Joanna had put on a tailored blouse of coral pink and a dark mid-thigh skirt, comfortable without being too dressy.
"Thank you," she said. "This is my personal furniture. I had it brought up from Savannah years ago. I assure you the other living quarters here are nowhere near as elegant."
"I see," said Foray, after the annoying lag. "The privileges of the wealthy." Joanna bit back the temptation to comment on Foray's luxurious apartment.
"I appreciate your taking the time to speak with me."
This time it took more than 3 seconds for him to reply. His brow furrowed, his mouth pursed. At last he said,
"Madame Brudenoy, it took a struggle with my conscience to decide to answer your request. I confess that my first instinct was to ignore it and remain aloof from you and everyone else in Moonbase until this crisis is settled. I think it's always best to discuss problems frankly, face to face."
His frown eased somewhat.
"Yes, I agree. That is why I am speaking to you.
What about our Declaration of Independence?" If the question jolted him, Foray gave no indication of it.
"Declaration of Independence? Pah!" He snapped his fingers. "A transparent ploy to avoid complying with the nanotechnology treaty."
"A right of every nation," Joanna retorted. "Just because we're on the moon doesn't mean we don't have the same rights as any other group of people."
"You are not a nation," Foray countered. "Moonbase is a division of a corporation."
"Moonbase is a community of more than 2,000 people. We have the right to be independent." His cheeks flushed. Foray waved both hands indignantly.
"But you are not a nation. 2,000 people do not make a nation. You can't even exist by yourselves without supplies from Earth. It is as if a group of people on an ocean liner declared themselves an independent nation. It is nonsense."
"We are self-sufficient," Joanna insisted. "We produce our own food. We can exist on our own without any help from Earth." That was stretching things, she knew, and yet a part of her mind marveled at the realization that the stretch was not all that much. Moonbase could exist without help from Earth. Foray made a visible effort to calm himself.
"Madame Brudenoy, you know and I know that this so-called Declaration of Independence is nothing more than the smokescreen, the camouflage to disguise the fact that you wish to continue using nanotechnology and evade the conditions of the treaty."
"But you intend to continue using nanotechnology once you've taken over Moonbase," Joanna said. Once he heard her words, Foray's face went from red to white, as if someone had slapped him. He took a deep breath, then said evenly,
"What makes you think that?"
Smiling, Joanna replied, "Don't you think I have contacts inside Yamagata Corporation? Several of the board members of Masterson Corporation are also on Yamagata's board." Foray sat in silence for several moments. Then he made a little shrug and admitted,
It is entirely possible that we will allow some work on nanomachines to continue,